You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2013 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Good evening and welcome to Aloud. I'm Louise Steinman, the program director for the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which, as most of you know, presents all of these free Aloud programs, and we're thrilled to have you here tonight to hear Dr. Robert Gale and Eric Lax talk about radiation. Now, my great pleasure to introduce tonight's speakers. Those of us in the baby boom generation, which I must admit I am part of, can remember things like going to shoe stores. I'm sure some of you remember where you could put your foot in those wonderful machines where you could see your bones glow. What we didn't know about radiation at the time was quite a lot. In the 1950s, the United States government detonated many above-ground tests of nuclear weapons at the Nevada test site, exposing the people who lived downwind, who became known as downwinders, to radioactive fallout. And I remember being in Ukraine a few years ago, and my translator telling me about when he was a kid, the day of the Chernobyl accident, a few days afterwards, was May Day, and how they had all the kids in Lviv line up for the parade, standing outside for many hours just a few days after Chernobyl. So the consequences of being ill-informed about radiation are deadly serious. When he heard about the accident at Chernobyl, Dr. Robert Gale, head of the bone marrow transplant unit at UCLA Medical Center, telephoned R. Armand Hammer of Occidental Petroleum and asked for Hammer's help in sending a message to Moscow offering radiation assistance to radiation victims. And 5 days after the accident, Dr. Gale was on a plane to Moscow and then to Ukraine. Dr. Gale was then appointed by the Soviet Union in the government in 1986 to lead the medical relief efforts for victims of the Chernobyl nuclear power station accident. And more recently, in 2011, the Japanese government requested that Dr. Gale be in charge of treating radiation victims from the deadly Fukushima nuclear disaster. Now, Dr. Robert Peter Gale, one of the world's leading experts on radiation, together with writer Eric Lax, draw on the most up-to-date research and on Dr. Gale's extensive experience treating victims of radiation accidents around the globe to correct myths and establish facts about life on our radioactive planet in our post-Chernobyl, post-Fukushima world. Dr. Robert Peter Gale, MD, is the author of more than 20 books, 800 scientific articles, and numerous pieces on medical topics and nuclear energy for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, the LA Times. For 20 years, he was on the faculty of the UCLA School of Medicine, and he has served as chairman of the Scientific Advisory Committee of the International Bone Marrow Transplant Registry. In conversation with Dr. Gale tonight, the co-author of this book is Eric Lax, who is the prize-winning author of Faith Interrupted, Conversations with Woody Allen, Life and Death on 10 West, The Mold in Dr. Flory's Coat, and co-author with A.M. Spurrer of a biography of Humphrey Bogart. I had the great good fortune to watch Eric in action when I was on the board of Penn while he was the president. He is a tireless and generous advocate for freedom of expression, and he continues to work as an officer of Penn International. It's a great honor to introduce. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Robert Peter Gale and Eric Lax. Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you. Hello. Thank you very much for coming. Are we on yet? Oh, good. Hello? There we go. Thank you very much for coming. It's nice to see you here. And Louise, thank you for that lovely introduction. And to Ken Brecker and to Maureen Moore of the Library Foundation and the Aloud series, thank you very much for having us. We're also very grateful. I know they did this just for us. Look at these wonderful cups they've given us. Look at they absolutely match. I think it's just great to do color coordination on these things. I'll spend just a couple of minutes sort of setting up what Bob and I have done, and then have a conversation with him where he can give us a tremendous amount of information, not only about himself, but about the subject of our book. Just before we start, if you, just a show of hands, how many of you have these deeply held, deeply seated, kind of unrealized fears of radiation? Is there, if you hold up a hand? Well, that's good. Well, you've come to the right place, because our intent tonight is to relieve you of those and to give you some really specific things to be deathly afraid of by the end of the night. So on that, the notion of this book came as our editor at Alfred A. Knopf, right after the Fukushima disaster. I was in Australia, as it turned out, and he sent me an email, and he said, you know where Bob Gale is? And I had just written Bob to wish him good luck going to Fukushima, because I'd read in the paper that he had gone there. So I wrote back, and I said, yes, I do. And he said, well, you know, it's time to, there's so much bad information out here, why don't the two of you write a book that sort of says, here's what radiation is, what you want to know, and try to put it into some kind of perspective. And he said, you know, I think we could really beat the market on this. This was April of 2011. We could do an e-book. We could have it out in September of that year. So that was 3 months. You know, what the heck? We could do that. Anyway, the book came out last week and took up a lot of our time. This is it's very complicated stuff. We'll try to do our best to make it comprehensible as we go along. Truth in Advertising, Bob and I have known each other for more than 50 years. We were classmates in college and have had a wonderful friendship that's maintained itself not only through the years but through the writing of this book, which was really, as Bob said the other night, he said, you know, we're not divorced. So it's really, so this is great. So let's just start off with the basic thing to get to Bob's experience with radiation, with why he was really the person to go to make this book work. Louise talked about Chernobyl. Here was this terrible accident in April of 1986 that we heard about in May 1986, because the Soviet government was a little slow in getting the news out. Bob saw the scope of the catastrophe and realized that because of the bone marrow transplant work that he and his team were doing at UCLA, is that radiation, victims of excessive radiation, really are people who are like cancer patients having a bone marrow transplant. Their immune system is being wiped out, and their blood-producing cells have been destroyed. And so just spend a few minutes, if you would. I mean, just tell us a little bit more of the story of Chernobyl.
Sure. Good evening, everybody. Thank you very much for coming. I really had two lives at that time. One is as a Sovietologist, and the other one as a physician. So I had a pretty precise idea of the medical capabilities of the Soviets to deal with radiation accidents. You can imagine that the United States has been tracking Soviet detonations and nuclear industry, you know, since 1950 when they had their first. And another completely unrelated thing, Armin Hammer and I were good friends and spent a lot of time traveling to Moscow for the funeral of Soviet leaders who were dying at a very rapid clip. You may remember Andropov, Chernyenko, and so forth. And at Mr. Andropov's funeral, I met Mikhail Gorbachev, who had been a deputy of Andropov. So when the Chernobyl accident happened, you know, this is very much what we do intentionally in order to treat people with cancer. So we have people with various cancers. You're all familiar with radiation therapy, but the extreme of that, of course, is when we have people with leukemia and we give them a very high dose of radiation to their entire body, and that's a dose that would be lethal. The idea, of course, is that high dose of radiation is going to kill all the cancer cells. But now we've got to step in and rescue them from the irreversible effects of radiation on their normal bone marrow cells, the cells that make our blood cells or red blood cells and so forth, and which we do by taking bone marrow from a brother or a sister or some other person. So if you think about it, a radiation accident like Chernobyl is a replica of what we do every day to cure people with advanced leukemia. And so, you know, I realized, number one, we have a lot of experience with this, huge amount of experience. We have a lot of resources. Our Soviet colleagues were very bright, but without any resources. And so, and I knew Gorbachev. And so the idea was, how do we get to him and offer our assistance? For two reasons. One, of course, is the humanitarian reason. You know, we want to help them. We want to help these victims. Second one is we'd like to know what happened. And if you all can think back, most of you are too young to even have been born at the time of Chernobyl, but, you know, information was not fabulously forthcoming in the Soviet Union. So, you know, knowledge of nuclear events has a strategic importance to us and to them. So an offer of assistance could help the victims, but could also get us inside the system. So that's kind of the story. Armin Hammer was sort of my guarantor of good character.
One of the, I think, misapprehensions about Chernobyl and the damage that was done is the number of people who died as a result of it. There were 29 people who perished either in the accident itself or from radiation poisoning later on of the patients that Bob treated. We'll get into the other numbers of that. But for a catastrophe of that size, and most of the people who died were firemen who rushed into the reactor, which they thought was a fire. The reactor was on fire. They had no idea that there was a meltdown and they were being exposed to unbelievably high doses of radiation, and that the burns that they had were not only from the fire but were also radiation poisoning and burns. And so this group of this cohort of patients was taken to Moscow, where Bob and his colleagues there. And if you talk a little bit about the treatment, I guess, if you could.
Well, So we fundamentally did what we had about 205 severely affected people that we brought to Moscow from Chernobyl, or Kiev, really. And we sort of sorted them into who has burns and who has damage to their bone marrow. And we actually had brought in the Russian army to help us with this process. A huge operation. But fortunately, of those 200, we only lost 29. So 90% or so of the people were rescued one way or another. Including the bone marrow transplants we did are well publicized, but we also used some hormones that had been cloned, molecularly cloned. I think I might tell this story.
Yeah, this is a great story. Please do.
We had been working at UCLA and others to develop hormones that stimulate the bone marrow in the same way that you know that thyroid hormone, you know, regulates your thyroid gland. There are hormones that regulate your bone marrow's production of blood cells. And so the gene for that had been isolated and molecularly cloned and produced in yeast. And so we had a lot of that we had been giving to monkeys. We radiate monkeys and give them this molecularly cloned hormone, and that would help their bone marrow recover. We hadn't given it to human beings. So at the time of the accident, obviously that was one of our first thoughts was, for the people who don't need a bone marrow transplant, can we make them recover more quickly? The problem was we hadn't ever given it to human beings. And so we contacted the manufacturer in Switzerland, Sandoz, and said, could you send us some of this hormone? And they agreed it had to be slipped into the suitcase of a Swiss businessman who was coming on some other unrelated business, and we actually had his baggage stopped. So it was put in after he cleared customs, you know, cleared it, and then we had his baggage stopped and the stuff removed before he got his bag back. And then the issue that arose was, of course, no government wants their citizens to be guinea pigs. And so the Russians, the people in the Politburo, were very reluctant to let us try this unless, you know, because the fallout from a negative reaction would be greater than the benefit. But we knew it would work. And so we said, well, what if we are the first people to get it, not the victims? And so the Russian physicians and I injected one another and...
calculating the dose that you needed from the what had been
from the monkeys. Yeah. And and some called it have called it monkey business, but you know, nothing bad happened to us, and then we were able to proceed. And
I mean, not to press too far on this, but there's the one alarmist thing that did happen.
Yeah. So the senior Soviet physician, I injected him with this material. He injected me, and then. I went off to see our ambassador, Art Hartman, at the Spasso House, which is the American ambassador's residence in Moscow. And I was feeling fine. And then I got a phone call about midway through dinner. You know, Professor Vorobyev is dying. And so I rushed back to the hospital, and sure enough, it looked like he was dying. I mean, he was white as a sheet. He was in the coronary care unit, clutching his sternum, his chest. And, well, after some careful examination, I realized that, you know, your sternum is where you have bone marrow. And this hormone was causing the sort of squeezing sensation. It wasn't really his heart. It was his bone marrow. Now, of course, the monkeys had said nothing about this. But this is a drug that we use now, you know, thousands and tens of thousands of cancer patients get it. And we know that's a common adverse effect of this hormone. But at that time, you know, that was our first experience. And I thought, if, you know, if Vorobyev dies, I'm never getting out of here alive. Yeah.
The subsequent time that the hormone was used was a couple of years later in Brazil. There's an accident that not many people are aware of. There was a huge accidental spill of radioactive material. Some basic scavengers had broken into a building where there was an old cancer treatment machine that treated with radiation, had cesium-137 and cobalt-60 in it, and they thought that this would be good for scrap, and so took it away and dismantled. We're very clever in the way they finally dismantled. These are very hard to dismantle. You know, they're dangerous, and you don't want people to get in, but they were able to do this. And there is a cascading story that goes on that's in the book about how this event happened, how much radiation really was spread around, how much radioactive material was spread around. And suddenly there was this group of quite ill patients in Brazil. And Bob was called in under some rather secret circumstances to do it. But it's a wonderful story because it has, you know, very few people suffer terribly as a result. But yeah. Go ahead and, if you don't mind.
Well, as you know, we have tens of thousands of radiotherapy machines all over the world, and they're interesting because you know, sometimes they just get abandoned. Doctors or clinics close, and these things are shielded in lead to keep the radioactivity within. And so it's not that uncommon that one of these things will be picked up for scrap metal and taken to a scrap metal facility and melted down. A famous story that, and that's what happened in Brazil. You know, often these nuclear things interact with nuclear weapons activities. So, for example, the reason Eric says that it's secretive is because at that time, 1987 or 1988, the Brazilian Navy was developing a nuclear weapons program. And, of course, you know, some kind of a radiation scare for the population is not good if you're trying to develop a secret nuclear weapons program. The Argentinians were doing the same thing. So... But occasionally these huge lead-encased things that have a radioactive source in them, like cesium or cobalt, will get melted down. And one episode occurred in a Texas town, and the metal was taken across the border, melted down and made into lawn furniture, wrought iron lawn furniture, which was then put on a flatbed truck and brought back to the States. It just happened to go by the gates of Los Alamos, one of our national laboratories, and so on the interstate that goes by Los Alamos. And so what happened was all the radiation alarms in Los Alamos went off. But no one was coming in and out of the gate. And so it was quickly realized that something must have passed by, and this radioactive lawn furniture, which was probably available at Target, was traced, and you know, the pieces were eventually brought back and you know, quarantined, let's say. But so this stuff is ubiquitous.
Just the last bit that I always enjoyed about this, about the Brazil story, is there was a Bob was kept under wraps. Literally, he arrived at the airport and was hustled into a car and made to lie down on the floor of the car to take him to his hotel and then on to the hospital, because he's quite famous at the time for having been at Chernobyl. It's a year later, and they didn't want anybody to see the famous radiation doctor sitting in a car. Why? What is he doing in Brazil? So he's like, and you and the British and the Brazilian admiral had a very nice relationship where he was. On the one hand, so grateful to Bob for what he was doing, but jokingly, he said, took away his passport and didn't want to give it back the day before he left because he was afraid that Bob might somehow spill the beans on what was going on down there. So,
yeah.
Anyway, so these stories, these radioactive adventures, these nuclear adventures are part of what's in here. But what we really tried to do with this, this book, and one of the reasons it took a long time is we like to think there's kind of a linear effect on things. This much radiation happens, you have this kind of result that comes in. This happens here, you'll get this disease. If that were the case, we could have put together some very nice charts and done it in a month and a half and gotten our ebook up in time. What we realized that in trying to tell the story of radiation and not only its ubiquity, for instance, it's a radioactive universe, it's a radioactive solar system, this planet is radioactive. We need radioactivity to live. Without photosynthesis, we're not who we are. At night, we are radioactive ourselves. At night, when you're lying in bed next to your partner, the one of you who has the more muscle mass is passing a greater amount of potassium 40, which is radioactive, to your partner. The other was passing a little less. So. But it is ubiquitous in our lives. It is everywhere. We need it to live. And it's neither good nor bad. It's actually good in some ways because we don't live without it. But we need to have kind of a reasonable approach to it and not be entirely fearful of what it's about. So we set out to try to do that. And one of the ways that it seemed to do is that people, we all like to say, well, I've been exposed to this or I'm going to have this test. You know, what's the likely outcome? If I do this, then what am I going to get? We spent a lot of time in the beginning of the book, and if for those of you who are kind enough to buy it, we do warn you when you get to those pages, and it's dense, but we like to think it would be rewarding. And there's only one word that you have to remember in it, that's millisieverts, and you get through, and you'll be okay. but the serious question about this is, you know, how do you assess risk? How do you find risk? And why is it so difficult to come up with an answer? So not to put you on the spot to do this in 3 minutes, but if you can talk about the problems of assessing risk.
Well, risk assessment is a complex thing because lots of things go into it. You know, one thing that goes into risk is, you know, what is the actual risk? And very often we don't know. I mean, what we know are some boundaries of risk. You know, what in statistics we call confidence intervals. So you often hear, you know, experts quoted as saying, how many cancers do you expect from Chernobyl or Fukushima? And somebody gives a number like 10,000, you know, which is something we call a point estimate. You're actually picking one point. But in reality, our knowledge of all of this is very foggy. And, you know, we should be speaking of ranges. And when I talk about ranges, I mean from 100 to 100,000. That's our real knowledge of risk. It's not 10,000, it's 100 to 100,000. The true answer lies somewhere in those boundaries, but we can't really quantitate it. And so that's one thing. The other thing that's important about risk is, as a society, we make a big distinction between risk that is voluntary and risk that is involuntary. So you want to go kayaking, that's a high-risk procedure. The average person who was exposed to radiation from Fukushima, of all the people we evacuated, about 160,000, they got a dose of radiation that's 1 millisievert. It's not important. Just that dose of 1 millisievert over a lifetime has the same risk of killing you as kayaking for 15 minutes. So, you know, but we kind of see these in a very different way, because kayaking, whitewater kayaking, is a voluntary risk. And having to be evacuated from your home is an involuntary risk. And so, you know, so risk is a very complicated concept. Mm. Also, and just one thing, you know, and when you talk about risk, we often sort of consider the alternative. So, you know, is nuclear energy risky? Sure. But what's the risk of producing the same electricity from something else? Oil, coal. And most of, I wonder how many people think, well, we can just ask, is it safer from under normal circumstances? Do you think you get more radiation from living near a nuclear power station or a coal-fired power station? How many people think nuclear is, it's kind of a loaded question. Yeah. Yeah, and coal? Yeah, I mean, coal, you know, it comes out of the earth. It has uranium and thorium in it. And when you burn coal, you have to burn a lot of coal to make the same amount of energy as fissioning a gram of uranium. Now, it's about 500 times more, about 100 times more radiation released by making a terawatt of electricity from coal than there is, you know, from uranium. And that brings up the last point I wanted to make about risk, which is societies distinguish not only voluntary and involuntary, but they distinguish predictable and unpredictable. So societies don't like unpredictable risks. Nuclear power plant blows up, that's unpredictable. Now, the fact that we lose, every year, about 40,000 people die mining and transporting coal. But it's a relatively consistent figure. So the loss of 40,000 lives mining coal globally is quite an acceptable risk to most people. But a nuclear power station explosion where 29 people die, or in the case of Fukushima, nobody dies, that's less acceptable. So there are a lot of different calculi that go into the assessment of risk.
One, I think, that was so interesting for of the two or three things I learned in this book, in doing this book, or two or three million things I learned in the book, is what age means in terms of risk.
What?
How your age when it
sure.
comes to risk.
So well, I think the starting point is just to maybe ask people, if you're in the audience and you're well, what do people think is your lifetime risk of getting cancer? I mean, how many think it's 10%, 20%, 30%, 40%? Or 50%. Yeah. So, I mean, for a 50-year-old male who doesn't have cancer, your lifetime risk of getting cancer is about 45%. Doesn't mean you're going to die of cancer, but your lifetime. So you have a 1 in 2 chance to get cancer in your lifetime. And it only goes down when you get to be quite old, you know, 70 or 80. People sometimes say to me, older patients say to me, that's great. You know, my risk is going down. I said, well, actually, it's not great because it means there's a higher probability of dying of stroke and heart disease. It's not a good thing that your risk goes down. But we start out with a huge baseline risk of getting cancer. And then now we're sort of saying, what's additive to it? You know, how much? So if it goes, if it goes from 50% to 51%, which is sort of the doses of radiation that we deal with, not in the public, but in people that are working in nuclear power stations, is that important to go from 50 to 51%? Well, probably not, you know, if you put it in that context. So, you know, these things are... We have to do a better job of explaining or expressing risk to the public. The public deserves a better understanding of risk than we do.
Another aspect of it is that if a 3-year-old and an 80-year-old are standing in the same place,
right,
and they receive an equal dose of radiation, the outcomes for the two of them will be completely different.
Sure.
I'll leave that to you.
Young people are, except for lung cancer, which seems to be an exception, where middle-aged people are at greatest risk. But for any other cancer, young people, for the same dose of radiation, young people are much more susceptible to cancer. And then you've got to go the distance. Right. And if you're 80, you're not going to go the distance to get cancer. If you're 3, you've got to go a long distance. So that's why, you know, when we look at current practices in the United States, Americans' dose of radiation has increased strikingly in the last decade or two, mostly from CT scans, from radiological studies done by physicians. And most of those studies are done in young people, either abdominal CT scans to rule out appendicitis or head CT scans to rule out trauma or seizures or headaches. And those young people, you know, have to go the distance, and that is of substantial concern.
There was a study that came out, it was in Nature, wasn't it, that the new evidence on the rise in cancers in young people who have had CT scans that perhaps unnecessarily. If there's a guideline to give you out of this is, Bob and I are just writing an op-ed for a journal now. It's saying should you use that gift certificate for a CT scan that you got for Christmas? And the answer is not necessarily to do this. Is that radiation that we receive is cumulative? We all get it naturally. You want to accumulate as little extra as possible. And one of the points that we make in the book is that, you know, there's a great deal of talk about backscatter radiation. You go through to the airport now and you go through this machine that goes around you. And how dangerous is that? Bob can go into the figures on that. The answer is that it's a minuscule amount. The first 5 minutes that you're up in the air, you'll receive more radiation from the atmosphere than you got from the backscatter machine. By the same token, exposing millions of people to even this small amount of radiation, the likelihood is that over the course of millions and millions of people, someone actually will have a cancer induced by this. So it's how you weigh it back and forth, and what your worries are. The other piece of practical information is, if you have a home with a basement, check it for radon. The greatest single source of radiation, the greatest, most dangerous source as far as our own health is concerned, is an ill ventilated basement where you're breathing in the radon that's coming into your home from the rock and the soil that is there. And go to True Value and get the little kit and put it in your basement for however long it's supposed to be, and send it into the EPA, and they'll send you back a result, and there are ways to mitigate it. So that there are unseen and unthought about kinds of radiation that we receive that we really give, you know, no mind to. The other is, of course, try not to smoke, but that's we can come back to that. In terms of it's been interesting is that one of the the things that Bob has been doing over the course of years, and what we've learned about great exposure to of radiation on people, it comes from the studies of the nuclear bomb victims of Japan from World War II. That cohort of people has been studied quite effectively over the course of years, and what we've learned about that has been quite interesting. The other is that that we found in the course of doing this and in articles we read and in speaking with people is the kind of misconception about when there is a catastrophe such as Chernobyl or Fukushima, what number of people have died as a result of this. We found an article in an Australian newspaper that said more than 1 million deaths are attributable to the Chernobyl radiation that was released, and that there's this huge cover-up that's going on. Or that there are terrible cancers and radiation victims from Fukushima. Bob has been on the among those studying the effects of the Chernobyl disaster now for 26 years following out. And I think that the figures from that are kind of interesting when you talk about the millions of people who were in the path of the cloud.
Sure.
And the illnesses that have come from that. So,
yeah. Well, it might be interesting to see, how many people think that there is an increase in cancer after Chernobyl in the European population, So we have studied this quite carefully. Several international organizations, including the WHO, World Health Organization, the United Nations. Let me start with the bad news. The bad news is that we have about 7,000 cases of thyroid cancer that occurred exclusively in people who were under the age of 16 at the time of the accident. So if you were over the age of 16, approximately, maybe 16 or 20, you were protected. And that's, I think, getting back to something that Eric mentioned, that young people have a different susceptibility than older persons. But we do have these 7,000 cases of thyroid cancer. Now, why is that? Well, one of the things that reactors release when they go to pieces is radioactive iodine, iodine-131. And, I think all of you probably know that we need iodine. We take iodine into our thyroid gland. Most of us have plenty of iodine in our thyroid gland, and there isn't a lot of space for any other external iodine. But in Chernobyl, that area around Chernobyl, especially Belarus, is an area of endemic iodine deficiency. So this was common in the United States before we put iodine into milk. So there was, what's called goiter, very commonly in America, but no one in America really has goiter anymore from lack of iodine. So you had a bunch of people whose thyroid glands, young people whose thyroid glands were deficient in iodine, and now we have all this radioactive iodine coming out of Chernobyl, and it lands on the grass. And then the grass is eaten by cows, and cows produce milk, and children, drink a lot of milk. In fact, in these rural areas, that's their major source of nutrition. And because of the undeveloped infrastructure of the Soviet Union in that area, we were unable to quarantine milk. We had a lot of people, most of the people living on small family farms with a couple of cows, and that's their source of nutrition for their kids. So we have an iron-deficient population of young people drinking a lot of milk, putting this radioactive iodine into the thyroid gland and causing these 7,000 cases of thyroid cancer. Now, the good news about that is that thyroid cancer is... I have to just say that thyroid cancer in children is so rare that I may have seen 10 cases before in my lifetime, and now I've seen 7,000. So this is a really striking increase. But thyroid cancer in children is eminently curable. So we've had maybe, very sadly, 15 deaths, but just 15 deaths. Now, for everything else, we may be seeing a slight increase in leukemia amongst the 600,000 what are called in Russian liquidators. I've told my Russian colleagues that that's not a good word. Liquidator is not, especially anyone who knows anything about Stalin. But we haven't seen anything in the general population. So there's no increase that we can document in several millions of people, 20 or 30 million people. That doesn't mean it's not going to happen, because, as Eric said, we've been following the atomic bomb survivors since 1945. And some of the cancers, most of the cancers, take 30, 40, 50 years to develop. But we haven't seen leukemias, which usually occur in the first 10 years. And so it's extremely unlikely that we're going to see a rise in cancers. So the bottom line message is this: yes to thyroid cancer, probably no to other cancers. Now, if I can translate that for a second to Fukushima, we don't think we're going to see thyroid cancers after Fukushima. Why? Well, firstly, we were able to distribute non-radioactive iodine to all the kids in the area. So by giving them this non-radioactive iodine, they were able to fill up their thyroid gland so it wouldn't take up radioactive iodine. Number two is we quarantined all of the milk and milk products. So no one was allowed to drink milk that contained radioactive iodine. And in Japan, that was very easy to do. And the third thing is that because the Japanese diet is very rich in seaweed and fish and things, people don't have this iodine deficiency. Even without our interventions, there are very little, if any, space in their thyroid gland to take up radioactive iodine. So we don't think there are going to be few, if any, thyroid cancers after Fukushima, and certainly few, if any, other cancers.
If you had a large container of milk that, in fact, did have iodine-131 in it, rather than throw it away, what could you do with it?
So I think what Eric is alluding to is, radioisotopes have a half-life. Half-life of radioactive iodine is 8 days. Some of you may know that. So in about 80 days or 10 half-lives, the radioactive iodine is gone. So that container of milk, if you make it into cheese, is now not radioactive any longer. So if you're into brie or camembert or something. Now, we have a very hard time explaining or convincing people that something that was previously radioactive is no longer radioactive. I think, Whole Foods is not going to go for this. But in fact, milk filled with radioactive iodine 80 days later is perfectly safe.
One of the astonishing the figures of the whole disaster in Japan is that it's easy to concentrate on Fukushima and the fears that have come out of that. But as Bob has pointed out, there may not quite be the balance of the fears that you would think. And that although we might focus much more on the dangers of radiation, real or imagined, that came from that, it's sometimes easy to overlook the fact that the earthquake and the subsequent tsunami were so powerful that the entire main island of Honshu moved 8 feet to the east. That 20,000 people died, 300,000 people are left homeless, either for a period or permanently in many cases. And that this huge trauma took place, this huge physical trauma took place. And that somehow gets us put aside when we think about what happened there, because it's easy to focus on kind of the one disaster that's scary that we in some way you can't put a hand on it. Radiation is unseen. You don't see the disaster from it in what it might do. And so one of the things we've tried to do is we have no particular theory that we advance. We don't promote or not promote nuclear power or anything else. We just try to say here is everything that there is, and here's what we think are the best explanations for what goes on, and for to allow people to make their own choices from there. I'm looking at this wonderful clock that we have here. The alarm's going to go off at any minute. So I think this is the time that we're meant to take questions. And so there are microphones. Is that? Yep, there we go. So if we can pass them around.
Have they tracked any of the populations that were downwind or upwind from our above-ground atomic tests during the 50s and 60s in terms of an increase in cancers?
Yes, that's a good question. So, yes, it's actually been tracked very carefully. And if you go onto the, I'm going to say the DOE website, but it could be DOD, and you put in your zip code, you can actually, you don't look like you were old enough to be alive during the atomic tests, but someone like me, you can put in your address, and you can actually just read out exactly what your dose of radiation, you know, the range, as I was saying, not the estimate for your address over the course of our 25 years of above ground tests. And you can also use a calculator to determine what your risk of cancer from that dose of radiation was. And, you know, these are not, for any one individual, it's, you know, it can't actually budge very much our 50% risk of getting cancer in a lifetime. But again, if we multiply it, you know, by millions of Americans, then you will come up with figures like 10,000 cases of thyroid cancer as a consequence of atmospheric testing. And, you know, all of this is a very strong reason why we and others shouldn't engage in atmospheric testing of nuclear weapons, and why I think we should support, you know, reductions. We can talk separately about elimination, but the reduction of nuclear weapons.
Very interesting talk. I had two questions. Feel free to answer either. The first question was about Fukushima and subsets of the population, like pregnant women, if there was a larger risk for them, like with children, or with the Japanese population eating fish, if there was a bioaccumulation from the radiation. And second question was just about San Onofre here in Southern California. It sounds like you're suggesting maybe there's a greater risk to flying than to San Onofre, and I just, speaking about, you know, assessing risk, if that was a true statement.
Well, Bob can do this, some of this better than I. With pregnancies, for instance, one of the figures that came out of the studies of the Japanese victims of the two bombs was that only in the second trimester of pregnant women were there any difficulties with birth following in the children. And that's really when the neural migration is taking place and something happens, or you get kids with largely brain problems or enlarged heads or problems like that. But the total cases in those were 27, something like that?
29 or
29 so. Of all of those who were studied. So it's not, and I'm not, when I was talking about flying, there is, because you're higher and there's less atmosphere to stop the radiation, you do pick up radiation in an airplane. But I wasn't comparing it to San Onofre or
no, freaking out relative risk. You're saying, like, you know.
Yeah, no, it's true. Here's the thing to think about, because when I tell this story to my friends who would say, "Oh, I'm so worried about the backscatter," I say, "You shouldn't be. You know, forget it. You know, the first 5 minutes, you know, you're going to get more." Then they're really freaked out. I mean, they go, "Oh my God!" You know what? And the only thing I can say is this: Bob has now been actively around sources of radiation, including a helicopter over the reactor in Chernobyl, which was spewing it out, for 25 years, has been to every nuclear disaster that's come along in the years following, flies probably 200,000 miles a year. Perhaps. I fly 100,000 miles a year. Neither one of us glows. I have the blush on, it helps. But, you know. but But here's Bob, who's been, you know, sort of a walking example of someone who has been around a tremendous amount of radiation, taken precautions almost all the time. There's an interesting story of in treating patients in Brazil who were so badly burned. The ideal thing would be to operate behind lead vests and have shields and things that you know. Well, if you have a critically ill patient, it's very hard to maneuver around that. So Bob and the team, they made sure there were no pregnant women or women of childbearing age who might be having them. They were all excluded from that. But they operated on the patients who, you know, were emitting radiation. And anyway, he's here. So.
Thanks for the discussion. First, one comment and a couple questions. Comment is, I think we're afraid of what we don't know when someone else has the control. Now, when nature has control over the tsunami, it's different. But when a government or elusive authorities have control, I think that triggers something for us. You said you were going to really scare us, and I haven't. I'm not feeling really scared. I'm feeling more like my anxieties are allayed. But I want to give one to you. I don't know if Bob, have you ever spent 2 weeks camping out at the Hanford nuclear site? Clearly, you've been many places.
I've been to Hanford.
Have you been to Hanford? Yeah. I'd like to ask you about that, because that's a situation of big questions for the people in the region. Policymakers, the late Senator Mark Hatfield said, that's a ticking time bomb sort of thing. So that's a depot for waste, and I don't know how that fits into your configuration of threats. Yeah. Thanks.
You've asked the right person, actually.
Yeah. Well, I mean, on your first point, if I just comment on that, because, you know, why is it that we have, you know, we try to explore in the book this fear of radio. I mean, obviously, people are radiophobic. But if you go back over the history of radiation, you will see that people were radiophilic. And when radiation was first described, people thought this was the greatest thing since beer in cans. You know, you could stand in front of a device and you could see all your bones. And that was going to be, I mean, you just think of the number of lives saved. You know, you could tell who had a broken bone, who had pneumonia. And, you know, that was regarded as something absolutely incredible. And some of you may be old enough to remember going into, probably nobody here, but, you know, you could go into a shoe store and put your feet into this device, and you could see your toes up against the end of the shoe. And even today, people who have a rare but unpleasant rheumatological disease called ankylosing spondylitis or other rheumatological disorders, they pay a lot of money to go sit in, you know, radon caves. So there are caves that have very high concentrations of radon, and people go to a resort and sit in a cave and spend money. And I actually sat in one of these in Bad Gastein in Austria, and the person next to me was reading. Austrians are incredibly radiophobic. I mean, they are afraid of having a nuclear power station. They wasted about $3 billion building one that was never commissioned. And they worry about Czechs and Slavs having nuclear power stations near Vienna. But this fellow who was sitting in this radon cave was reading a newspaper article about the closure of a Slovak nuclear power station. You know, so there is this kind of... So one of the things we've explored is how did this thing shift? How do we get from radiophilia to radiophobia? And part of it is what you say, that is, the whole thing has been managed badly. You know, the secrecy surrounding nuclear weapons development, you know, a lack of transparency is a major and fundamental issue. And the other thing, though, as Eric has mentioned, and I think yours is that most dangers to us are apparent. Okay, you know, stick your hand in a fire, you get the idea quite quickly. You know, if you go over the sort of to the end of a precipice and you look down, you understand that this, you better step back. But, you know, radiation is not something that you have any natural appreciation. I mean, other than visible light, microwaves, radio waves, your television set, ultraviolet radiation, we can't perceive. So you don't know if you're not being radiated, you know, at this moment. And so we kind of lose our natural instinct for it. So coming to Hanford, for those that don't know, Hanford Reservation in eastern Washington is where the weapons material was made for the first atomic bomb. It was a wartime. It wasn't, not everything was kosher. Not everything was done brilliantly. And there were a lot of releases, particularly of radioactive iodine, that were known to the plant operators, but not known to the people living around. And then we have these tanks of radioactive waste that are kind of, have been leaking into the Columbia River. So the issues in Hanford really are thyroid cancers, people that are 40 or 50 or 60 years old now that were exposed to high doses of radiation, because a lot of people living in around Hanford, you know, also lived on farms, not dissimilar to the people living in Ukraine and Belarus, and they had their family cow, and, you know, and they were drinking milk. And then there are the Native American people. A large part of their diet consists of eating fish that they catch or caught in the Columbia River. And the issue there is colorectal cancer. So that is the subject of a huge, I would say, unending lawsuit between the people living in eastern Washington State and the federal government and the contractors, which I don't expect to actually end during my lifetime. But it is of concern. You know, I mean, it's not so much as that it's an active problem, but it's trying to, get a just return, you know, come to some terms with these people. It's like the downwinders from Anuravada test site. You know, how do you compensate people for things that were done secretly?
To finish the question on fish in Japan, because that's such an...
fish in Japan, this has actually been a good thing for me, because I live in Japan, I live very close to Tsukiji Market, which is where all the tunas come in, you know, and people are afraid of eating tuna, so the price has been going progressively down, and that's been good for me. But it depends on the kind of fish. So the very bottom-dwelling fish tend to accumulate cesium. Most fish that are not, you know, bottom dwellers readily exchange the radioactive cesium for non-radioactive sodium and potassium that, of course, there's a lot of in the ocean. So, I mean, you would, I think we calculated that you would have to eat a half a kilogram of tuna every day for a year to get a substantial dose of radiation. Now, this is a little bit different, I just, for interest's sake, about what happened after Chernobyl, because a lot of the Chernobyl radiation was deposited in Scandinavia, not in the ocean, but in lakes that don't have an outlet. And when you have lakes that don't have an outlet, you have a concentration of this stuff. And so there are still lakes in northern Scandinavia where you can't fish. I mean, it's not recommended that you fish. But I just want to say that, you know, most people think that the deposition of radioactive materials in the ocean is a bad thing. You know, it sounds actually dreadful. But in fact, from a physician's point of view, it's the best thing that can happen. You have a huge amount of radioactive release. Depositing in the ocean dilutes it out tremendously. Now, the oceans are normally radioactive. The oceans are hugely radioactive from nature, because the ocean is really the accumulation of all the water that drains through the earth and picks up uranium and thorium, everything. So the ocean is radioactive. We and the Soviets have dumped tons and tons and tons of radioactive material into the ocean during the Cold War. In fact, the dumping of radioactive material in the ocean has only stopped in the last 20 years. So, you know, although I know it sounds bad that 80% of the Fukushima radiation went into the ocean, in fact, that's a really good thing. That is protecting human beings.
In the early 70s, when I did cancer research, most experts assumed that 85 to 95% of cancers were caused by environmental pollution, air, water. I was just wondering what you thought about that as a relative risk.
I think I'll let Eric. No, I think, you know, my opinion is that that is a wild overestimate. But, you know, there, you know, it depends what you call it. I mean, do you include cigarette smoking as, yeah. I mean, so when we start adding things like that in, alcohol, cigarette smoking, you know, we get up to high numbers. You know, 10% of cancers can be attributed to cigarette smoking. But, you know, as our population ages, you know, cancer is a disease of aging. And it's fundamentally a recent disease. I mean, if you think about it as an evolutionary biologist, you know, people were not living long enough a century ago to develop cancer. So, you know, there hasn't been evolutionary time to develop, you know, we develop evolutionary defenses against infectious diseases, but there hasn't been enough time from an evolutionary scale to develop defenses against cancer. Just, it's a recent...
Well, the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah. I mean, not that Egyptians didn't get cancer, you know, 13,000 years ago, but as an epidemic, you know, accounting for a third of deaths, that's something in the last 100 or 150 years.
And also, just in the last 50 years, the amount of radiation that we've been taking in, not from natural sources, but from man-made sources especially, largely about 80% of it comes from medical use of one form, or, you know, medical testing and medical uses of one form or another. So, and that number is growing at a steady clip as we go through this. So. Yes.
This is a real neurotic, radiophobic question. For those of us who travel regularly through airports or go into government buildings where we're constantly being x-rayed, and then our bags and our packages are being x-rayed, and all the stuff in our packages, like our clothes and our snacks and our gum, is that stuff continually giving off any kind of radiation afterwards to us? And if so, how can we mitigate it?
Yeah, so I mean, just... one technical point, you know, you have to distinguish internal and external radiation. So your bag goes through a scanner. That's it. There's no radiation deposited in it. Nothing is radioactive, so forth. Nothing becomes radioactive. You going through a scanner is another matter. So then, again, you don't become radioactive, but you are exposed to radiation. So, I mean, on an individual basis, these are trivial amounts of radiation to the person. I mean, the benefit of not having someone, you know, inside, if you go to the courthouse, you know, and they x-ray everything, not having someone in the corridor shoot you is worth the risk of going through the scanner. But, you know, when we think of it on a societal level, millions of people every day going through backscatter radiation and so forth and so on, millions of people going through scanners. You know, the one thing we have to do is we have to reduce the dose to the lowest possible level to achieve the desired effect. That's the name of the game. We've got, now, I mean, I just put it in perspective. If you live in Denver, Colorado, because you are a mile higher, and because the Rocky Mountains contain all these radionuclides, you are going to get twice as much radiation every year as living in LA. Now, we don't see a different rate of cancer in Colorado or in LA. So, you know, apparently people, you know, if you say to someone, you know, you could move to LA and reduce your radiation dose by 50%. Now, I mean, there'll be a lot of reasons to try to get out of Colorado. But most people are not leaving because of radiation dose. So that difference in just is more than you'll ever get going through all these scanners and so forth and so on.
We have time for two questions. So we'll do one from this side and one from that side. So with the you pick whomever. Yeah, sure.
When I put my feet into the X-ray machine to see if the shoes were fitting back in the 50s, I wonder if that was there's a possibility that that's responsible for the fact that I have arthritis in my toes.
Probably not. I mean, arthritis is not a disease that we think of as radiogenic. You know, it's not, for example, in the atomic bomb survivors, arthritis is not higher in the people that were exposed versus unexposed. So I don't think that would be the explanation. But those machines did give a hefty dose of radiation. And they're now illegal, of course.
And again, one of the underlying things that is that why we talk about that radiation may not, in certain instances, be as bad as you think it is. It's certainly, again, not something to seek out. You know, get it when you need it,
I would get a new balance. You know, has every width and every.
And can you just pick somebody up there? You got somebody here? Okay.
Hi, I am a radiophobic. I grew up in Brazil in the 80s, so I was very familiar with that. And recently I found that the smoke detectors in the houses have radioactivity, and because we recently changed one in our house. And when we went to dispose, I found out that there's no regulation for throw it in the trash. Does that pose any threat for, like, the trash, where the trash is collected? And where that amounts to?
You're better on this.
Well, I'll just talk about the radiation, the smoke detectors for a second. So, I mean, that's a perfect, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's a perfect example of balancing risk and benefit. You know, these smoke detectors and that green sign over there, that the exit sign, you know, they use radiation that uses tritium to light it. And the smoke detectors use a radioisotope to detect particulate, so the disruption of electron beam by these particles of smoke is what sets the smoke detector off. Now, you know, if you think, it uses americium to do that. But I mean, if you think of the number of lives we save by smoke detectors or by exit signs versus the radiation risk, you know, it's completely trivial. We save tens or hundreds of thousands of times more lives. This building, the structural integrity of this auditorium, is guaranteed by X-raying every one of the beams that's in the building. Every time you get on an aircraft, that aircraft has been X-rayed. You know, the structural integrity of the aircraft, we use X-rays to make sure that the rivets are intact, that there aren't cracks in the wings. And so this is, generally speaking, a very favorable trade-off. You know, we get a lot more radiation, a lot more from radiation than we lose. It's really quite favorable.
And it's,
but again, you got to reduce the dose. That, you know, radiation does cause cancer. And so whenever you know there's a radiation exposure of any nature, you know, we have to be asking ourselves, is the benefit worth the risk? And one of the points that we make in the book is when you go to your physician and he says, I want to do this or that study, you should ask him or her, more likely to be her nowadays, you know, what are you trying to find out, and how is that going to affect my care? You know, we have a huge debate going on about mammography. You know, when should we start doing mammograms? Age 40, age 50. You know, we're talking about millions and millions of American women. You talk about the difference between age 40 and age 50, you're talking about large numbers of radiation-induced leukemia cases. So we have to know, and when to stop. You know, do we stop at age 75? We have to know for each, you know, of these issues, when does the risk-benefit ratio turn against us? It's not, you know, as Eric was saying, if you got, some of you may have gotten a gift certificate for a whole body CT scan for Christmas. You know, it's not necessarily a good thing.
And the other is that we talk about in signs or whatever, but it's also in building materials. If you're standing in Grand Central Terminal in New York City, you will be exposed to more radiation coming naturally out of the rocks that are in the buildings. You're standing next to the U.S. Capitol than you would in a properly running nuclear power facility.
So.
Oh, the disposal of them. The problem of disposal.
Disposal of smoke detectors or the disposal of radioactive waste? Yeah. Well, the amount of radiation, the actual amount of radiation in a smoke detector is so small that the battery is much more dangerous than the amount of radiation in the smoke.
And on the question of mammograms we're talking about, it's the real debate is it's not over if they should be had. There's no question they should be. It's over when, and the real debate that goes on is not whether they're useful, but it's during what, how often, and at what age do you start? That still is an ongoing debate. I think that we've used up our time. Thank you so much for your patience and your good questions, and for coming out. Thank you. Thanks.
Allowed is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolfe, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.